Hey, everybody. Welcome to Defy. This is a podcast about stories, because everyone has a story to tell. We're all about sharing stories of women and non-binary individuals and how they have defined the odds, persevered through incredible circumstances, and transformed their lives. Is this a show about perfection? No, because it doesn't exist. Is this a show full of empty self-help quotes for you to put on your Instagram? No, that is not our style. This is a show about breaking the rules, creating your own path, and being your true self. Because remember, well-behaved women rarely make history. Non-binary folks excel at breaking models. So come on, let's get out there and defy. Hello, Camille.
Hello.
I'm so excited to speak with you today. And I want to start out this podcast a little differently than I typically do. Usually there'd be some witty banter and some fun story about how we know each other. And I want to talk about this too, but I wanted to read an article that I think is going to provide a really nice framework for the conversation that we're going to have today. And I promise that this article is not long. So do you mind indulging me?
Of course. Go ahead.
You're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So that sounds fine. So this is an article that was written in the Marquette Wire. So from Marquette University by Hope Moses, who is in their opinion, she's an opinions columnist. And this was published October 20th, 2020. And I'll put the link to this article in the show notes. And she said this. Black girls are being deprived of their innocence due to the over-sexualization of their existence. Sexualization is the practice of excessively sexualizing individuals, an act that Black girls and women are heavily subjected to. And this deprivation of innocence has deep-rooted history in the United States. When Europeans traveling to Africa during the 15th century saw the minimal amounts of clothing that African women wore, which of course was appropriate for the hot climate there, and the seemingly suggestive tribal dances that they observed, this led Europeans to believe that African women were sexually lewd. During the slave era in the United States, Black women were referred to as Jezebels, and this term was used to suggest that Black women were innately promiscuous and sexually predatory. And it was conceived that Black women had an insatiable appetite for sex, which slave owners used as a justification for rape. And the views that Black women are innately promiscuous and sexually predatory is exactly why Black girls do not have the liberty of being children. Instead, they are forced to live in a world that turns their innocence into a sex symbol. And as children, Black girls worry about the clothes that they wear, how much skin is showing, and what their actions might suggest. Black girls grow into Black women who face similar struggles. And as adults, Black women have to be conscious of how they dress in professional settings and how others may perceive their bodies. The perception of Black bodies, like the notion that is a Black woman's bodies are inappropriate, could result in workplace harassment and even being fired. A 2017 Georgetown University study found that Black girls as young as 5 are already seen as less innocent and in need of less support than white girls of the same age. And this presumption leads teachers and other authority figures to treat Black girls as older than they actually are and more harshly than white female students, with the disparity being particularly wide for 10 to 14-year-olds. And this research only confirms what was previously known by members of the Black community, which is that Black girls are viewed as more belligerent, violent, and aggressive than their white peers. So the adultification of Black girls is not just about the objectification of Black girls. It's the idea that Black children are in less need of protection, and this exacerbates ongoing violence against Black children in America. And it's why this is important for all of us, and especially for teachers and authority figures, to recognize our own biases against Black girls. There is no one person that is innately promiscuous or sexually lewd. Black girls are not belligerent, violent, or more aggressive than anyone. Black girls are an unprotected group of people who deserve better and who deserve their innocence. And I just thought that that was a really good way to frame the conversation that we're going to have today. And the reason I chose to read, and by the way, I didn't read that entire article. I read most of the article, but I will link the entire article to the show notes so people can read it themselves. Because when you and I have been talking over, you know, the last couple weeks, this whole idea, and especially as we've been reading Morgan Jerkin's book, This Will Be My Undoing, it's, you know, obviously shed a tremendous amount of light and perspective for me as a white woman who, you know, I've always considered myself to be very conscious of bias as much as possible, to be very open to different ways of thinking and understanding, and to understand the type of privilege that I'm allowed to exist within. While, you know, yes, I'm a woman, and, you know, women are fundamentally a marginalized group, I'm still a white woman, and there's special privilege in that. The conversation that you and I had this week, and again, reading Morgan Jerkin's book, has really, you know, shed so much light for me on the incredible intersectionality that the Black women that I know have to face being both Black and a woman, and how this has really impacted a lot of people's professional experiences. And so when you and I were talking about your story, I was like, gosh, I think this was a really nice framework for understanding, for people to understand that this kind of over-sexualization of Black women's bodies and the lack of protection for Black women's bodies is manifest itself every day for people, and it's manifested itself for you. So before we talk about your work experience, I wanted to just provide a little more context for everybody. You're a young, you know, BCBA, you're, you know, super smart, and you just started this, you know, new business, and you have a husband and a great family. And so the, you know, from, I think from the outside looking in, people are like, oh my gosh, you know, Camille has it going on. And you do in a lot of ways, but that also doesn't mean that there's not, you know, some other stuff that's been really challenging and things that continue to be challenging. So you were born in Palo Alto, but I wanted to really back up before you even came into existence. And I wanted to talk about your mom. And can you just kind of provide a little information in terms of like, who is your mother? What's kind of her, you know, family of origin? And how has her experiences and her life really impacted you specifically?
Yeah, so definitely I can talk about my mom all day, just because she's just an amazing person, and how she presents herself now, you would never know that her story was what her story was. So she actually, when she was really, really young, she didn't meet her mom until she was 18 years old. And she didn't really have a relationship with her dad. Her dad didn't raise her because he was in prison for about 25 years. So she actually was raised by her aunt. And from her experience and the things that she's told me, she said it wasn't really a positive experience for her. But she, before she got placed with her aunt, she actually was in homeless shelters with her and her younger brother and sister. But with her, she's had this, she told me about this dream that she had when she was younger. She just saw herself with a lot of different children. A lot of different children of different ethnicity, different race, like, you know, just so many different children. She didn't know what it meant. But back then, she knew that her life was supposed to end up a certain way, but she decided to go and defy all odds and basically try to break those generational curses the best she knew how, because she didn't have anyone who could support her. You know, she was in special ed when she was younger and growing up, so she didn't know what her out was, basically. But she knew that what she was seeing within her family is not something that she wanted for her own kids. So she has five kids, and we have another brother that we adopted, and she raised us on her own. So there was a lot of things that she instilled in us, as far as she wanted my brothers and sisters and I to remain close. So regardless of what happened, what's going on in the world, that was one of the things that she wanted to leave as a legacy. And I am proud to say that that is something that she has done. My youngest sister is 22 and my older sister is 30. So, and we all still keep in contact, and we all, you know, when something's happening with one of our siblings, we kind of round together and figure out, well, how do we move forward with this? So that's something that she completely instilled in us, and it has set us up for success in that area. However, on the other side, as far as like her parenting, now I know that she did the best that she could, you know, with what she had. She didn't have a model to show her, you know, this is how you raise your kids. So she just basically went off of the things that she kind of learned. But, and a lot of it was kind of, she raised us in a bubble of fear, I would say. That's the best way I could describe it. So making sure that, you know, we're not around her daughters, especially not around boys. She didn't want any hoochies, she calls them. Mm-hmm. She didn't want any hoochies as daughters. She didn't want her sons, you know, having babies at really young ages. And that's just not something she wanted. But in that, it just kind of suppressed a lot of questions that I had. So for me, I was the kid that always got in trouble when I was younger. My mom always had to tell me to stop talking. She always had to tell me to, like, you know, close your legs and go and do something that girls do, you know, play with Barbies. But I wanted to be outside running around, all of this stuff. So for me, like, I always had to fight against that. I didn't understand why. And I don't think she understood why either, mm-hmm. honestly. And yeah. And you mentioned earlier about the book, Morgan's book, This Will Be My Undoing. I recently read it and it just opened my eyes, and the resentment that I held for a very long time kind of made me realize, well, this is her perspective and this is also my perspective, and I understand. So all of those things that she told me, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, it makes so much sense. Like, that was her survival mechanism, basically, yeah. in order for her to live in this world that she was given.
Right. And she thought that she was being protective, you know, to you and your sisters. And just like the article that I started with, this idea that Black girls are not allowed to be girls, you know, and they're not allowed to be innocent. And, you know, and there's studies to show that this starts at age 4. And, you know, then are those adjectives, those aggressive adjectives, those belligerent adjectives, and how, you know, especially maybe for your mom, she didn't even necessarily realize that this is inherited, right? It's an inherited narrative through her family and through our culture. And, you know, to not have the words to kind of conceptualize that and understand that. And then for you to be a kid and to be like, but why are you telling me how to be, or why can't I just be myself? But it's just me. I want to be outside. I want to do these things. And so I'm really glad that this book has really helped provide perspective. And my hope is the conversation that we'll have today, obviously, you know, this is an opportunity for you to kind of share who you are, but really I'm hoping that the latter part of this conversation can be like, okay, so all of this stuff exists. How do we work together to do something about it? Because I am a mother of a Black daughter, and I don't, you know, I've worked really, really hard to try to allow my daughter to be herself and to find the space that, you know, fits her, and to not feel like she has to grow up so fast. But I also recognize that it's easier for me to shelter her as a white mother. But then there's also going to be, you know, shortcomings because I'm a white mother. And so there's just, you know, there's so much complication to this, but I don't accept a world where we can't make concerted, conscious, and loving actions, or take concerted, conscious, and loving actions to look at how we do this better for our daughters and our daughters' daughters. Because this shit needs to stop. So we talked a lot about the fact that you guys were moved a lot, and there was just not a lot of stability in terms of where you were growing up. And that likely for your mom, she kind of grew up that way. And so it wasn't a big deal to her necessarily, but that had a real destabilizing effect for you and your siblings. Cause you felt like you didn't have roots, but you guys really moved and put down roots to a certain extent when you moved to Tulare, California. Can you describe for people that are not aware of where Tulare, California is? Why is this like a very interesting choice for your kind of family, and what kind of environment was it?
I always talk so much crap about Tulare because I hate it. I do not like it at all. But I have to give a little bit of grace because my husband was born and raised in Tulare, so.
And we like him.
Yeah, we do. He's not, He's very different from a lot of people in Tulare. Let's just say that. But it's in between Bakersfield and Fresno. So it's the central valley south of Fresno.
Yeah. So this is for people that don't understand California. This is not the beach. Yeah. Tulare is not LA and it's not San Francisco. It's the central valley. And that's where agriculture is. That's where it's more conservative. Like, it's the California that's affordable because you're in the desert and it's really hot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's either hot or it's cold. There's no in between. There's no, you know, that's just what it is. But so in this town, there aren't, it's like you said, it's very agricultural. So if you don't know someone or you don't have family who's in the ag business, then you're kind of just living there, I guess. So I never met any Black people who had land and who had, you know, farms and different things like that. That wasn't the norm. So for me and my family, we actually ended up moving there because my uncle moved there and that was like the only family that we had. So we had family in Sacramento when I used to live there. But when we moved, we mainly moved because of my uncle lived there. But there weren't very many Black people in that area at all. So there was like an east side and then there's a west side. And on the west side, you know, that's where most of the Black people lived. On the east side, some Black people lived there, but not very many. But for me, and my mom did tell me that she did this consciously where she wanted to live on the east side because, you know, there were better opportunities. There were better schools. So that's what she wanted. So we lived on the east side and we moved there my fourth grade year. So it was the summer before my fourth grade year. And it was such a culture shock, the biggest culture shock. I didn't even know it was a culture shock at that time, actually. But my very first day of school, I'm sitting there with my little twisted pigtails and, you know, I'm going to school like normal. I love school. But there was this white girl that was in my class and she just stared at me. She stared at me and she smiled. And I would kind of, you know, when you feel someone looking at you and they're kind of just like, you look to see if it's actually happening. But
yeah.
It was happening.
You're like, I feel like your eyes are like boring a hole into the side of my head. Is this really going on? Yeah.
Exactly. So I would kind of like look like, man, this girl's weird. Why is she looking at me? And I'm only in fourth grade, so I have no idea what's going on. But then, like, I didn't really talk to anyone. No one really talked to me, but she was the only person that talked to me in that class. So she ended up being my best friend that year. And I didn't have any other Black people in my class. And in fact, moving forward from like fourth grade through high school, it was very rare that I did have another Black person in my class. And if I did, more than likely, it was because it was my cousin.
You're like, I'm related to them.
Yeah, he was in some of my classes because I was in a lot of like honors courses and AP classes in high school, and he was in some of them. But that was really it. So that's the only, that was the only kind of, I don't even know what to call it. It was just weird because it seemed like I didn't have any relationship with Black people unless I played sports. So unless they were on my sports team, that's the only time they interacted with me. But other than that, I didn't have any in my classes. So I didn't have that opportunity to like make those connections with them there. So it was a huge culture shock. And that's part of the reason why I hated it so much. But also, you wake up in the morning and the first thing you smell is cow poop. And I have a very sensitive nose. So that's just, I did not like, it was so aversive for me.
Yeah. You're like, really? You're like, I'm here and it smells like shit. Like, yeah. What's up with that? You wrote to me, you said that you learned very quickly how to be someone else. You kept quiet, observed, you didn't say very much, and you poured your energy into homework and focused on getting good grades. So your grades from the fourth grade to the 12th grade were all A's, except for one B plus in your AP history class. Because you were just like, okay, then, you know, I'm just going to get my work done because I see my pathway out of Tulare through college. Mm-hmm. So that's exactly. That's the ticket. You're like, let me just handle my business. I'm going to work really hard. And so that is the light at the end of my tunnel. So you took AP courses, honors courses, and you got into like every school you applied to.
Yeah. So in high school, I kind of had this idea of you know, I'm at, it's like the last leg. This is all I have to do to get out of this town I absolutely hate. So when I was there, before I even graduated, I told myself, I will not be going to Fresno State. That is not something I want to do. It's not even on my radar. I'm not even applying to it. Because I know if I go there, my mom's going to make me go there. But yeah, so I graduated top of my class, valedictorian, and I got automatic admission to all the UCs except UCLA and Berkeley. Those were the two that I actually had to like apply and do everything for. But my dream school was UC Santa Barbara. And I was like, well, I already got into UC Santa Barbara without even applying. So that's where I'm going. Like, no questions asked. I'm done. They're paying for my tuition, my housing. I don't have to worry about anything else. So then I think it was, I can't remember exactly when, but toward the end of my senior year, and I had told my mom this, and she was really apprehensive about it. She did not want, she didn't want to have anything to do with it. And the program that I went through, they said that I had to apply to Fresno State because I was part of the program. And I was like, oh my goodness, you guys are giving my mom the ammunition that she needs.
Yeah.
So obviously I applied and got in, and my mom told me, I'm not taking you to UC Santa Barbara. So that was like the most heartbreaking thing I've experienced in my life at that time. Because I didn't get to go to prom. I was really upset about that. But not being able to go.
Because she wouldn't let you go.
Yeah, she wouldn't let me go to prom either. Not even my senior prom. And I would fight with my mom all the time to let me go. But yeah, she told me, and that was her only excuse. I'm not taking you to UC Santa Barbara because if something happens to you, I can't get to you. So that kind of goes back to her parenting in like this fear bubble.
Yeah.
So it's like everything I had worked hard for, I hadn't even thought about, you know, if something bad happens, it was just, I need to get out of here and I get to go to my dream school. And I did this. But when she told me that, I was shattered. And I actually resented my mom for a very long time after that. Like, it took me a couple of years. Even now, it still bites a little bit. And I look back and I'm like, oh, what if I had just gone? If I just didn't listen to her and I just went. But then I also had this, one of my weaknesses is being a people pleaser. And I did not want to go off to college without a relationship with the only parent that has been in my life my entire life, who's like done so much for me. I didn't want that on my conscience. But now I think about it, I'm like, oh, she would have forgiven me. I should have just went.
But it's, but you were like 18, you know what I mean? So you're like, yeah, like, am I going to have this like conflict with, you know, the stable force in my life? And so here's like the interesting piece. So you know, of course, didn't want to go to Fresno State. That's exactly where you ended up going to. But the silver lining of Fresno State, for people that don't know this, is they have a really great program in behavior analysis.
Yeah.
And you found that. Mm-hmm. And that like changed everything for you in terms of your focus on work. So talk about what it felt like to, you know, discover ABA and the impact that made on you.
Yeah, so it definitely stemmed from, I was already a psychology major. I knew that when I went into college, psychology was going to be the thing that I studied, because I always asked a lot of questions when I was younger, but I always wondered why people do what they do. So in my head, I'm thinking, well, you know, I have these so many questions about, why is my mom behaving this way? Like, why is she doing this? I just didn't understand. And she wasn't able to explain it to me because she didn't understand either. But I actually was walking down the hall one day and I just saw, I needed a job my sophomore year. I had no idea what autism was. I had no idea what ABA was. So I went ahead and applied, and I got the job, and I was so excited, my very first job. And when I first started working at they actually had a clinic on campus, I absolutely fell in love with it. It just made sense to me. Like, and I feel like I was naturally good at this particular thing because my whole life I went around just observing other people's behaviors and trying to figure out, well, why are they doing this? So then, you know, ABA kind of gave me those answers, you know, and that kind of started to make me realized that this is where I want to stick with. So I ended up, you know, applying, or all the classes that I took moving forward were to get an ABA certificate in my undergrad. So I went ahead and did that. And when I graduated high school, or when I graduated undergrad, I was going to go ahead and apply to the ABA program there. But I had other ideas of, you know, I wanted to go ahead and maybe I'll try to go to Columbia, because I had a director that was really trying to encourage me to look into it and see what they have to offer. And I was really excited about that. But then some other things happened with that and it didn't really happen. But ultimately, I just decided to get my degree online so that I can work full time, because that was something that I needed. I was the only one that could provide for myself. So that's what I had to do. I had to do what was necessary.
When was your brother diagnosed with autism? How does this fit into your story?
Yeah. So it's interesting, because even, you know, I didn't know what autism was in the very beginning. I had worked at the clinic at Fresno State for almost a year until, no, not almost a year, maybe half a year before we fostered him. So my family did foster care. And when he was about 10 months, that's when I started to notice some of the characteristics, especially with his fine motor and just like his responding to certain stimuli and things like that. And I actually told my mom, like, maybe we should get him evaluated. And he was pretty young and I knew it was a process. So I was telling her it's good to start getting him evaluated now. So originally they diagnosed him with ID.
And I told my mom, intellectual disability.
Yes, intellectual disability. And I told my mom, like, that I don't think that's the right diagnosis, because he had a lot of skills. Mm-hmm. His deficits were just very subtle. So she ended up fighting and, you know, having him get more evaluations. And he didn't actually get the diagnosis until 2 years after. But because of my little bit of history in applied behavior analysis, I did, you know, give my mom some tools to kind of help with my brother before that happened. And even that in itself was a whole transition, because the advice that I was giving her was, you know, she's my mom, I'm her daughter. She's always been this mom that's, you know, what I say goes, and I'm doing things the way that I know how to do things. So even coming in with her, you know, trying to show her a different way was such a struggle. But eventually we had this like sit down and we both broke down, and I was just kind of telling her, you know, you can't raise him the same way you raised us, because it's not going to work. And the things that she tried, it didn't work. And it wasn't until she kind of changed how she parented with him where she started to see, okay, like, you know, I do have to make certain changes. I do have to change my whole history of parenting. Remember, she raised 5 kids on her own. And just seeing her doing it with my little brother, it's a huge thing. Like, it's such a huge thing, because she is someone who's very set in her ways. But even now that, you know, he's 8 years old now, all of my brothers and sisters are way older. So we always talk to her and tell her, like, you know, well, you didn't do that with us, and why does he get to do that? And all these different things. And we joke with her about it, but it's just really cool to see that transition, or that change in her parenting style.
Yeah. Which I love. And I think that's one of the things that we know is incredible about having a circumstantial view and fundamentally a behavior analytic view on how we interact with the world, is that we're not like these like static beings that can't grow and change. And if we provide enough reinforcement and make things, you know, look at response effort and try to make things easier and more effective and reinforce crap out of it, then people can change what they do. Especially mm-hmm. once they realize like it's working and they're like, oh my gosh, you know, and then you can just kind of build on that, you know, kind of momentum, and it's awesome. So you're going to grad school online to be able to get your master's degree so you can, you know, become a board certified behavior analyst. And you have a number of really, you know, challenging employment experiences. And I think what's interesting is once, and I don't know if you felt like this, like once you started actually writing this out, when you sent me kind of this initial email when we were talking about this interview, and maybe you've already done this, kind of connecting the dots on like, where's the threads of commonality here? Like, why, like, but then there was this thing and it didn't go well, and this thing that it didn't go well, and this thing that it didn't go well. And when we were talking earlier this week, it just struck me. I was like, oh my gosh. The thread of commonality here, at least in part from my perspective, based on what you've, you know, said to me, I obviously wasn't with you when these things happened, is the perception of the people that were in supervisory positions or colleagues of yours in your workplace on who you were as a person because of how you present yourself. And so do you want to just kind of talk in like broad strokes in terms of like where were some of like these experiences that you kind of had in multiple different places, which left you just wondering like, what's wrong with me?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it started out with the first job that I had. I actually ended up staying there for 5 years. So I was pretty stable, started out with, you know, basics, didn't know anything. And by the time I left, you know, I had experience with training, you know, incoming therapists and things like that. But when I worked there, you know, we had a director and then we ended up getting another director. But the second director that we got, they came in with so much knowledge and so much experience. And I was so excited. And I was just like, oh my goodness, like I'm falling in love with it even more. And this person kind of gave me specific opportunities to, you know, build on my career, which I didn't think was possible because no one's ever really invested in me in that way. And so I had this little like, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, like, oh my goodness, maybe I can do something great with this. But I did have a supervisor, and I don't know exactly why. To this day, I don't know what the real reason was, but I felt that they just did not want to see me succeed in that way because it wasn't their success. So that person kind of did whatever they could to get, to kind of like stop that success from happening. And it was, when it was happening, I didn't really understand. I knew that the supervisor doesn't like me and I don't know why, because they would interact with me and joke around with me and, you know, laugh and different things like that. But I just knew like there's something off. They just don't like me. So as soon as I'm reaching this peak of, oh, I'm, you know, someone's investing in me, all of that was taken away. And it just was like a whole 180. It just completely mm-hmm. switched where, you know, my director ended up accusing me of something that I didn't do as far as like, I don't know, putting a specific protocol in place that wasn't ready to be in place. And I approached them and let them know, like, you know, it wasn't me. And they continuously said, yeah, it was. And then when the person who did it was like, oh, it was me, they were like, oh, you know, I just kind of, you know, I knew that you could handle it if I would like say something about it to you. And at first, you know, it was kind of in front of everyone and I didn't want to make a scene. Obviously, I don't want to be the angry Black woman. So I was just mm-hmm. like,
because okay. You're the only Black woman. Also, let's be clear about that. You're the only Black woman. So you're like, great. I now get to represent everybody as myself. Like, yeah, that's a mm-hmm. like huge burden.
Yeah. Well, there was another Black woman that worked with me, but their passion wasn't really ABA. So it was, you know, they were working there, but this was like where I was going to stick with. And, you know, I kind of just let it happen in front of everyone. I was so embarrassed. And then I actually ended up pulling this director aside and like talking to them, you know, I felt like at that moment, why am I having to do this? Why am I the person that has to go to that person and say, you know, if there is something that you think that I did or you want to ask me about, like, you know, just pull me aside and ask me if I did it. I'll be honest with you. I understand that, you know, you're my boss and that's not something that I would ever do. I wouldn't go behind your back and make my own decisions. And I haven't had a history of doing that. So it was just a really weird situation. But after that, you know, nothing worked out in my favor. So some things happened there. We ended up getting another director. And this director, I have no idea what it was, but this director just did not like me. So it was so bad to the point where I asked a question and they were talking to another coworker and they said, go ask Camille what that question was. And then that coworker was standing literally next to this director and they said, oh, Camille, this, you know, so-and-so wants to know what your question is. And I kind of just laughed to myself because I was just like, oh my God.
Like I'm right in front of you.
Yeah, I can't believe this is happening. So instead they came over and walked over to me and then I asked the question. But even in that moment, I was just so confused. Like, why is that happening? So I didn't really think twice about it. And then there was another instance where this director was getting on me again. And my friends that I worked with, they were like, what is wrong with her? You know, and I was just like, oh, I don't know what it is, but some things happened there. And there was a whole structure change of the clinic. And a lot of the people that I worked with this director was getting rid of like a lot of the employees just, you know, to downsize. And I knew that I wasn't one of the ones that they were keeping. And my peers around me knew that I was not one of the ones that they were keeping, but they were staying, but no one told me. So I'm just kind of like, well, I'm waiting for someone to tell me, at least one of my supervisors who had been, you know, pretty close to me, I guess, at the time. I expected them to tell me, but no one told me. So I ended up just reaching out and finding another job on my own because I was like, I'm not going to sit here and wait for someone to tell me. Clearly they haven't told me. Everyone knows. I have to do something about it. So yeah. And then that whole experience was completely, it just wasn't a good experience at my next job that I worked at. And there were times where, you know, I would even recommend some certain things because I was a training coordinator and I would recommend us, you know, taking data a certain way based off of data, presented data. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. So, like even when I would present a problem with giving, you know, solutions, it was never received. So that was something that I had to deal with and work with, you know, in my whole career. And when I moved to Oregon, I had a particular supervisor who would not look at me while they were answering the questions that I asked. So instead of looking at me, you know, when you're having a conversation, you don't have to stare at the other person, but, you know, you make eye contact and kind of look away and respond. They would specifically look at someone else completely like on the other side and answer my question while I'm on the other side of them. And it's so weird because I never really said anything about it. I would mention it to my friends a little bit, like, I wonder if they're doing this to me because I'm Black. But I always got the, no, that's not why. That can't be why. So I had to just, you know, keep it to myself. And I thought to myself, am I crazy? Like, am I thinking this because I didn't do anything? You know, I don't have any particular write-ups or any disciplinary actions or anything. Like, why does this keep happening at every place that I'm going to? It was something that I didn't really realize what it was. But this year, when everything kind of hit, you know, with George Floyd's murder, that whole thing kind of put everything into perspective and it just kind of made it click for me because I was wondering, I couldn't help but question, were these people treating me a certain way because I was Black? And the reason I didn't really think about it then was because I told myself, I will never let someone discriminate against me because I was Black. I will never give someone a reason to. And regardless of what I did or how hard I worked or how, you know, yes, ma'am of an employee I was, I can't help but ask, is that something that, you know, contributed to all of these different things that kept me from being successful, you know, the way that I could be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also, part of what we had talked about too is, I mean, A, you know, how do you find, like, how do you confirm that? Like, I don't know, but it also, you know, of course, like the typical, you know, person, if they don't understand, you know, kind of the intersection of race, you know, socioeconomic status, like physical presentation in terms of how people are treated would say, well, you know, the common denominator here is you. So like this must be, you must be doing something wrong. And you had already been in those kind of like shame spirals yourself in your own head. And again, I think there's so many people and you're obviously not like the first like colleague and friend that I've talked to that has been like, oh my gosh, you know, I already knew that I was like, the odds were stacked against me. So I did everything, not to 100%, to 500%. And I tried the hardest to like do all, like just fit perfectly in the very narrow space that I'm afforded. And I still got shit on. So what do I do with that? Because the way that you kind of wrote all these out to me is you called them strikes. And so you're like, there's strike one, there's strike two, there's strike three. And the strike three was, you know, just this past fall. And I remember you reached out to me on Facebook and you sent me this great message, which is why I responded to you, because we didn't know each other. And you were just like, hey, you're like, here's, you know, I see you. This is kind of the stuff I'm trying to do. I think, you know, it would be great if there was a chance for us to connect. I hope that you're open to it. And I was like, I always like to reinforce people that, you know, make the first move. Because I think for so many people, and I think for especially women in business, like, dude, no one's going to do it for you. So if you don't put yourself out there, you'll never know what you might get back. And so I always respond to people, even if I don't have time or I can't do the things they're asking me to. Like, I don't want people to feel punished that, hey, I took a chance. And I'm just like, oh, I'm too busy. I'm too cool. I can't respond to you. Like, that's nonsense. So I wrote you back. And you were like, holy shit, you wrote me back. And then we talked and then, you know, we've been talking. But it's like, what do you do with the culmination of those experiences then? So if you're like, okay, I feel like I tried to do all of the things. And also I think it's important for us to kind of talk about like your physical presentation, because this matters. You know, because you are a Black woman, but you're also beautiful. And so how, you know, and I'm not saying that to like blow smoke up your butt. I'm just saying that just because like those are facts, right? Like you're a beautiful woman and who is also a beautiful Black woman, that is who you are. And I know like there's also that additional layer of like, but if you're too pretty or if you have too good of a bot, you know, then there's, especially because our field is predominantly women. But most of the time when there are men working in our industry, they're in positions of power. Mm-hmm. And so as, you know, women, we socialize to compete with each other for the attention of men, whether that is relational attention, whether that's, you know, status attention, whatever, that's what we're taught to do. And so when there's someone within the group that someone feels, you know, has that advantage, it's much, you know, it's astonishing to me the lengths that other women will go to try to tear that person down. And some of those are conscious and some of them are not. And then you add on the additional layer of race, and this becomes, you know, potentially a recipe for failure for you as a person. And that's what you've experienced. And so then moving forward, and this is like the part of the discussion that I want people to understand, we want to strike a hopeful tone here, not because we can't be truthful about things, but I'm not the type of person where I'm just like, oh, let's just talk about like how horrible this is and that I am just so sorry that this is happening and thanks for listening to the show and catch you later. But where do we go from here? So you decided, and you reached out to me originally because you're like, hey, the corporate system is not working for me. So me being an employee somewhere else, like I am finding, you know, these challenges. And again, not to say that, you know, they're like, everyone messes up. Like that's life. We're humans. But to have these just kind of like successive, you know, punishing experiences. And as you called it, like your strike three, you were like, okay, I'm listening to what the universe is putting down and it's not a lot of love for me. So let me try to do something on my own. And so you really wanted to start your own parent coaching business. Can you kind of talk about what led you to want to focus really specifically on that?
Yeah. So it kind of, my passion for training kind of started back when, I was first getting a taste of, hey, I see that you're really good at explaining ABA in a way that someone who has no idea would understand it. Like, I would like you to train, you know, the new hires and different things like that. So that was like my original passion. I just loved teaching people how to use it and how easy it was and how cool, you know, you can apply it to your daily life. You can apply it to your work, like in all different aspects. So when I was finally a BCBA and I was like, you know what, I have an opportunity to work with parents, and I start to realize the system and how the corporate world works for, you know, different ABA companies. It's kind of like a doctor's office. You bill for the hours. Don't get very much time with the parents. The focus really isn't on parent. It's more on the client or the child. And I kind of go back from my own history in parenting and I see how the different changes that, you know, I kind of helped my mom with, and she kind of learned as well with teaching my little brother. And I saw that is where, you know, the change really happens. So I thought, you know, if I'm working directly with the parents, I'm cutting out that middle person. I don't have to worry about training an incoming therapist that has no idea what ABA is and teach the parents myself, because I would, a lot of the RBTs or therapists that I trained, they were parents themselves. And that's kind of where I realized that I can actually really make a difference with, you know, just explaining ABA without using the terminology in my teaching, but just explaining it in ways that they would relate to and how they can see an easy and effective way to make just little adjustments in their parenting, and how that would, you know, open up so many doors for them being confident in their parenting. So for me, I noticed that every single clinic that I worked for, parent training was always like the last. You know, BCBAs avoided doing parent training. And I was always the one like, well, why do you hate it? Like, I love it. It's so fun, you know, all these different things. And I even had an idea to kind of start like a parent training, like even group sessions on the weekends or something like that. But obviously, no one would really listen to the things that I had to say. So I was like, screw this. They're not going to do anything. I can't sit around and kind of keep working in this treadmill of a system where I'm just, you know, billing hours over and over and over, working, being overworked and underpaid with little to no effect. I'm going to try to do something on my own. You know, once COVID hit and we're working from home, I'm working with a lot of the parents on my own initially, or because they didn't want someone in their house, you know, all of these different things. And I'm doing it via telehealth. And I just had this epiphany, like, why am I not doing this on my own? I don't have to worry about someone telling me that I can and can't do something. I don't have to worry about the massive amounts of data collection and report writing that takes up a bulk of the time in our client privilege, not client relationship, or whatever you want to call it. So I just have to do this on my own. I can be my own boss. But I always told myself when I was younger, there's no way I'm going to be an entrepreneur. That life is just not for me. Can't do it. Don't want to do it. Don't want to have to deal with it. And here I am, like, you know, trying to figure out this whole entrepreneurial world and, you know, disseminating ABA in a different way, which is, I'm coming in at a really weird time because I don't really know very many, you know, BCBAs. I actually don't know any BCBAs who are, you know, online coaching strictly for parenting. But even going into the online world where there's such a divide in the ABA community, where now a lot of these children who went through the system and, you know, got therapy at different places and had very traumatic experiences, they're the ones who are the adults and the young adults who are saying that ABA is really, really bad. And it breaks my heart because I completely understand where they're coming from. Like, I've seen so many different things. I've cried so many tears advocating for them. I've fought so many fights, but no one would ever listen. So now I'm in this space where I'm like, okay, I have to be very careful about how I'm presenting this, because with parents, you know, they're not, if they have autistic children, they're not always autistic themselves. So they have that same perspective of someone who doesn't have autism. They don't, you know, they don't really get what it means and what it feels to be that. But having that experience, you know, with my mom and how her parenting was, and how I always thought, like, if you just did something different, like, it'd be a lot more effective. We wouldn't have to go this route. And then my little brother and, you know, helping him. And I see him like my little baby, because he was 2 months when we got him, and I've seen him grown. And my mom always tells him, like, I'm going to call Meal Meal if you're not listening. And I'm like, I don't know why you do that, because it's so funny, because he told my mom, see, Meal Meal never yells at me. She just talks to me and we talk about it. And I just cracked up laughing, because I'm like, well, good. He's having the positive experience with like how I'm engaging and responding to the different things that he's doing, and he's learning. He's like flourishing. So I just wanted to kind of give my gift to, you know, the world. And I say my gift because it's something that I feel like it just kind of came to me so easily, so naturally, and I have a passion for it. So I'm just kind of like, if I have a passion for it, why not? Why not continue to do something I love for the rest of my life?
Sure. And I agree. I do the thing that I love every day, and I wouldn't live my life any other way, because like, you only have like one turn around the world. So like, make it your best. But this also doesn't solve for, you know, another reason that you wanted to start your own business is you're just like, I'm exhausted dealing with, you know, these issues that I think you now understand likely are also, you know, interconnected in terms of, you know, how, who you are, your presentation, your race. But at the same time, you know, the deck is stacked against you as a Black female entrepreneur. And you know that too.
100%.
Yeah. And so part of the reason I wanted to have this conversation is to just talk about what also we're trying to do, even within the Defy community, because like, we get this. Like, we get this. Like, I, you know, was an entrepreneur. I started my own business out of my house in East Oakland. I ran it for 15 years. I sold it to a private equity company, you know, 2 years ago. And that was, you know, it took everything out of me. And I was in the right place at the right time for a lot of things. I was able to make mistakes in a different way that people can't now, because this was like, you know, when you were like in elementary school, so before social media. And I'm also still have like my white privilege and networking connections. And so if you take away some of those things that were really kind of helping to encourage and bolster me, and you're like, gosh, I have this passion. I know I have this skill set. You know, what you need is the network and the support system. And that's really what we've been trying to work at together in Defy. And I know that you've been a part of like some of the lounges. And again, this is like, I'm not trying to be like selling people on membership, like look at how amazing we are. But just to say that like, this is how we're choosing to address an issue. And the issue is that, you know, women and non-binary individuals, people that experience gender discrimination, don't get paid the same as men, obviously. You add on different, and you know, other identities on top of women, whether, so white women definitely don't, Black women definitely don't, transgender, our transgender friends definitively don't. So like, what do we do about it? And I believe strongly that it's two things. It's, you know, creating a network of friends and colleagues, but especially friends that allow you to explore some of these concepts in your personal life and in your own identity that allow you to learn who you are, to better understand who you are, to better understand the context with which we operate, to really help you clarify, like, what do you want to be about and how do you do it? But then also address the socioeconomic piece and the pathway to wealth in the United States is business. It's business. You know, whether that allows you to be able to buy a house and have multiple mortgages, whether you want to run a nail salon or an ABA clinic. It's small business fuels our economy. And so we understand if you were going to be a great small business owner, you also have to be like real good with yourself. And those things are interconnected, and there's an intersectionality of that, because that's also how life works. And so I'm hoping that you can continue and we can continue to support you to be able to develop yourself and sense of self and in your own personal support network, and concurrently be able to come in contact with a network and support system that can help you elevate your business to the next level. Because, you know, it's like the dream's been deferred multiple times, Camille, right? You know, UC Santa Barbara, deferred prom, deferred, you know, clinical director positions, you know, deferred. So like, let's stop that, but let's do it in a way that we know is going to be effective. And I think we can do that. And I know that you can. Like, I believe in you. And so I love like you and you. I'm reading. I'm looking at the email that you sent me. You're like, hey, I don't know where my story goes from here.
I was like, I'm done. That's all I have.
Yeah, because you're in. I would say what I feel like for you is, there is the dream deferred, but right now you're kind of in like the dream unrealized category. And like, but moving to realize. So what we would like to put you and help you do is go from the unrealized to realized phase in a way that is guided by what you want and your desires and your heart and your skills. So I'm hopeful that we can do that because I'm excited to see the realization and what you can, you know, offer so many different families because we know how vulnerable families are. And we also understand that, like, gosh, parents are like the biggest piece of any kid's environment. So why are we not like spending a lot of time helping these people because they have like the greatest impact? And if we can do it in an effective way that doesn't just totally overwhelm them and where they can get wins and start to feel competent, like, oh man, like that's just some powerful stuff right there. It's powerful stuff.
Yeah. I always like to say that parents have like the biggest role to humanity because they are our life teachers. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care how, regardless if you're absent or you're present, like you have an impact on your children and that shapes the world. So
yeah.
I know it's a little bit deep, but I am that type of person. Mm-hmm. But I think right now in my life, like I'm on this journey to really aligning who I actually am, because it's something that I'm kind of discovering more mm-hmm. With what I want to do. And now that I'm, you know, in this space where, you know, I have my own business, I know that there is no way that I will ever let anyone, you know, me being Black, me being a woman, I will never let that hinder me from doing what I'm supposed to do on this earth. So I'm so excited for this. There's a lot of like nervousness with it, but it's like nervousness that fuels me, you know, like I'm not going to stop. I'm already on this path. I've already seen some sort of success. So I got to just kind of keep going with it.
And I'm here for it. So thanks for listening to Defy. We really appreciate your support. And we hope that you listen to all of the different podcasts that we've put together. And guess what? We're available on all of the podcast platforms and on social media too. And we even have a website. Like seriously, we have all of that stuff. You can find us at www.defy.community. You can find us on Instagram at defy.comm, on Facebook using the same defy.comm, or you can even send me an email if you just want to chat about something or if you have an idea of a podcast that you think would be really great for our community. Our email is contact@defy.community. We hope that you have found something that you can take away from this podcast that will impact your life. We hope that you continue to defy society's expectations of you, because remember, baby, well-behaved women rarely make history.